This is
Cyber Station USA.
I warn you, their ingenuity goes hand in hand with their technology.
I think it's fair to call this hostile territory. For you, I'll make an exception.
What you hold in your hand is the proof of their power.
Come here. You're not hurt, right?
But, yeah, If These Walls Could Talk is the name of the book. It got released in October, and I'm happy to be on your show to talk about it.
Yeah, let's talk really quickly about writing a book. You know, your successful NHL career, and you decide, I'm going to go ahead and take a venture like this, especially how busy you are with the NHL and all these different media engagements. To go and do something like this and have the time to write it is a big challenge, isn't it?
It is. I've never written a book before, and I wrote it with Josh Yowie, who writes for The Athletic, the local athletic here in Pittsburgh, and Josh did an amazing job of, you know, because I'm not physically writing the book. I'm not the one actually on the keyboard writing. That's Josh's job. My job was to tell the stories as in-depth as I could. And to be quite honest with you, the book kind of got a life of its own. It was originally to be a story about my time as a Pittsburgh Penguin from 1982 to 92 and winning those two championships back-to-back in 91 and 92. And maybe dabble a little bit into how I became an NHL player and then how I've segued my playing career into a broadcast career. But Triumph Books out of Chicago was very generous and allowing us to widen the lens, so to speak, and go back to my childhood and my abusive is probably the best word to use it, both physically and verbally, my relationship with my dad, and then just the trials and tribulations that I went through segueing. It wasn't an easy segue into a second career as a broadcaster. I struggled a bit, and I talk a lot about that. So as much as it's about hockey, there's a lot about life in the book, too.
Now, I'm going to have one more question, Dr. Hall, before you get to a question. Phil, so basically, you're talking in a lot of ways with this book in two different avenues. One about your career and your life, but also the Penguins. And with the title of If These Walls Can Talk, we hear about these things sometimes all the time, right? The different books that Triumph does.
Yeah, it's a series. I'm one of the few former athletes of the team of These Walls Could Talk. I think Jerry Remy is one of the former athletes that actually wrote If These Walls Could Talk, of course, with the Boston Bruins. And there's one or two, but most of the books were written by team historians or somebody that's in the media that's followed the team a long time. And so that's probably why they gave me such license to not only go so many layers deep of being somebody right there in the locker room on the bench and being brutally honest about it. But they also, and a fair warning, there's a bit of a disclaimer here. There's some language in the book, and there's a lot of people who read the book and are not offended by it. It's nothing over the top. I'm a little sensitive because I have a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old, and I'm not sure if I'm ready for them to read the book yet because it's, and I don't want to use the term locker room language, but it's just the language that we use as hockey players, just going back and forth and how we talk to each other. And so it can be a little bit raw, but also I think it brings you right into the locker room and right in on the bus and on those team flights and on the bench. And you feel like you are right there. And I think that's what Josh did a great job of taking my words and making people feel like, wow, this is so down to earth that I just can easily go from chapter to chapter.
And that's very good. So, Dr. Hall, what question do you have for Phil?
Oh, no, just a quick question maybe about where he grew up and where he's from and pretty much how did he get interested in hockey?
Well, it is an interesting story. I grew up in a town 40 minutes northwest of the city of Boston called Chelmsford, a small town, a lot of hardworking people, very close to the Hampshire border. My dad was an athlete. He went to Boston College, played both baseball and football there. My dad didn't really push me to play hockey. He had a friend of his who was a a skater that played a little pickup hockey and just invited me to go with him one day to public skate. And he said, I took it to like a fish to water. He said, hey, maybe you should get your kid. Told my dad, get your kid on the ice. My dad ended up flooding the driveway with the hose, and I just couldn't get enough of it. And that, you know, quickly progressed to just a love for the game, where I've told this story a few times that, you know, if I was 5, 6, 7 years old and I had a game in the morning, I would wear all my hockey equipment to bed. And if I could have worn my skates to bed, if my mom would have let me, I would have done that too. But I don't know where it came from. I don't have a great answer for you. I just have this, and I have the same passion now as a broadcaster as I did as that 6-year-old kid waiting to play, you know, a Mike hockey game. And, you know, there's a lot of injuries. There was a lot of people saying, oh, you'll never make it. I was never drafted. I was just a simple invite to the Pittsburgh Penguins training camp and somehow got myself a contract. But, and again, this, I'm really going fast forward through the book here, but the one thing that never wavered was my love and passion for the game and what I was willing to do to get to the next level, even though, you know, I faced a lot of hurdles and a lot of people said I'd never make it. I also had a lot of people come into my life that extended a hand that either steered me in the right direction or, you know, physically grabbed me and said, no, you're going this way. And somehow it all worked out to have an 18-year professional career.
Absolutely. And the thing that you look at, Phil, is your journey. And what a journey. And that journey to the Penguins, when you first got there, did you expect it to be such a long stay with Pittsburgh?
Yeah, when I first got to the Penguins, as I mentioned, I was just an invite. I was promised a couple nights in the hotel and a little bit of meal money. And I got myself a contract, but didn't make the big club. I ended up in the minors. And I spent quite a bit of time in the minors before I figured it out on what it was going to take to get to the next level. So, yeah, 10 years with the Penguins. And I don't know how much you know of the Penguins in the early 80s. We stunk, man. We were bad. I mean, there were people that would go to the games and they would put paper bags on their head. Because when the 11 o'clock news came on and they showed the highlights of the game, they didn't want their friends or their buddies to see them sitting in the stands, so they put a bag over their head. I mean, that's how bad it was. And, I mean, you could buy a ticket to sit in the last row of the upper balcony, and you could easily go down and get your own section down in the lower bowl.
I remember completely, before the black and gold uniforms.
Before the blue uniforms. But as soon as Mario Lemieux came in 1984, it gave us hope. It gave us a superstar, and we slowly but surely started to build better players around him. And, you know, he came in 1984, and, you know, 6 years later, we were Stanley Cup champions.
Yeah, and then all of this, because, again, I'm born and raised in Pittsburgh, huge Penguin fan for sure. And, again, I remember those days. Can we beat the Islanders, for goodness sakes? You remember that, Bill? Can we remember the Islanders winning all those cups? Are we ever going to beat them? And where we started to develop from the Penguins to finally making the playoffs and struggling through all that process to finally becoming a dynasty.
Yeah, you're right. And the city was starting to be known as the City of Champions. As you remember, the Pirates,
yes.
You know, they won in 79. You had the, you know, the Steelers winning their Super Bowls. And the only thing missing was the Penguins. And at times they were a laughing stock, and you're right, there was times when the Islanders would just run roughshod over the Penguins. We had this long stretch where, you know, we just couldn't win a game against the Philadelphia Flyers in the Spectrum, and they would just beat the snot out of us. And so, yeah, we were a bit of a punching bag in the NHL, but that changed very quickly. And I mean, by the time Mario got here, and now we've had a second wave too, with Sidney Crosby coming in, that, you know, we're year in and year out, our expectation, not our hope, but our expectation is to win a Stanley Cup again.
All right, Dr. Hall, next question for Phil.
No problem. I really want to bring out this point, mainly that adversity builds character. And Phil summarized, I mean, he's actually went through a lot of adversity. I mean, he talked about the issues with his father. He also had a very traumatic accident, you know, where he fractured his neck in 4 different places. Then he's also experienced what's called CTE through hockey, okay? So, Phil, you're also a very tough guy. I mean, tell us, how have you been able to deal with this adversity Are there any points that you could point out for our young people out there today who are listening today?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think part of it is just you kind of have to have that. You're kind of born with it, that ability to overcome, that also that inner drive that when somebody says, oh, you're probably not going to make it, that only makes you salivate even more. I can remember when I didn't get drafted in 1982, I remember the Boston Globe newspaper had all the names of the players drafted. I cut it out. I taped it to the mirror of my dresser, and in black Sharpie, I put, "Where are you?" on the top of it, and it motivated me every time I woke up in the morning. It makes for an interesting book and an interesting life that, I don't know, I'm just, it's just the way my life has been. I've had incredible highs, but my lows have been incredibly low too. You're right. You know, like I mentioned with my dad, you know, the verbal and physical abuse that I had to endure and overcome that. And then you mentioned my climbing accident in August of 1994, where I fell 4 stories while I was rock climbing, free climbing, and broke my neck in 5 places, fractured my skull, broke all my facial bones, and had to get airlifted to Flagstaff, Arizona. And I probably should have been paralyzed, if not dead, from that fall, but I was able to overcome that and continue my playing career after that. So I've been partly lucky, but also there's just something inside me that my whole life has been a bit of a roller coaster road of ups and downs, and I'm stronger because of the downs. You know, some people say I'd never change things. Well, I'll be honest with you, there's a couple of things I wish I could change. I didn't have that climbing accident, and my dad didn't beat the crap out of me when I had a bad hockey game. I wish that never happened, but it made me who I am today, and really, I feel like there's nothing I can't overcome, and you're right, when preparation meets opportunity, that's usually where you have success.
That's such the part of what Dr. Christopher Hall brings to the show, Phil, is how he dealt with adversity. Phil, he is a doctor, but he was a ward of the state, dealt with some really difficult times, got in trouble with the law, but then became an emergency doctor. So, Phil, yeah, kind of inspiring thing. And I think that when I am becoming a connoisseur of Triumph books, I've worked with them for 5 years interviewing authors. And you're the first at these walls can really, because you're an athlete writing this book, is sharing your story compared to, you know, sharing other athlete stories that didn't write it.
Right.
A tremendous job to really kind of open your heart up to sharing with fans that are Penguin fans and NHL fans of what you dealt with. You should be commended for doing that, because that's really getting out of your comfort zone.
No, that's exactly what the book did. It got me out of my comfort zone. I've also realized now as a broadcaster, also I find part of my responsibility is to do public speaking and talk about my ups and downs. So this book was kind of an extension of that, but as I mentioned, went a whole bunch of layers deeper than I normally do when I speak to groups. And it was cleansing, actually, to talk about my dad and talk about all the ups and downs. So now I actually enjoy it because I see how people react to it. I do also, I didn't finish answering your question about CTE, that the thing is,
right,
and I know some people have a strong opinion, some people are confused about it. I'm more of the latter. I'm confused about it, unless you're going to crack my head open, to be quite frank about it, and you're going to be able to test me for CTE. Nobody really knows when you have it, why you have it. Everybody says it's from contact sports, but I also understand that people who don't play contact sports can also have CTE. And I don't think that just because somebody is depressed and somebody wants to take their own life, that I don't think it's an automatic connection to CTE. And maybe I'm just not educated enough, but I think that it brings up a lot of conversation about where CTE comes from.
We have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shakeup to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
Cyrus Mission USA.
Cyber Station USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. Cyber Station USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple.
Stitcher,
a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA, always on the go.
Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The CyberStation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide. Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.
Comes from, how it affects everybody differently, that some people can have, you know, 15, 20 concussions and they're not depressed and they're not suicidal and they're not, you know, blaming it all on the sport that they play. That it's such an interesting topic. And I just wish we knew more about it while these athletes and not just athletes, but people who are depressed and it could be related to CTE. I wish there was a way that we could test for it earlier to diagnose it and help people who are really struggling right now.
That's a true thing, Bill. I'm a former professional wrestler and I sometimes see signs of CTE. I didn't take maybe the shots to the head that you did, but I took a lot of chair shots, garbage cans, everything in the book in Independence when I was wrestling down south of the Rock and, you know, Moon Dogs and all the old school guys. And it's hard because sometimes I do see it happen, certain symptoms. And Phil, that's the problem. We have not done enough testing yet to really understand this, how it affects a person that's an athlete that's gone through so many traumatic shots to the head.
Yeah, and I don't want to make it just about me, but on a personal level, I mean, I can probably list 10 times I was knocked completely cold, out cold, and had concussions. So yeah, in the back of my mind, now in my 50s, do I worry about it? Yeah. Do I have lapses in memory? Yeah. Do I think right away, oh, is this a sign of CTE or is this just, you know, me being a little bit tired and having a rough schedule this week? And that's the reason I'm forgetting things. So I don't know. I know that some athletes are being heavily compensated because of what's happened to them in the past. I'm not one of those. I knew what I bought in on. I will say this one last thing about CTE and hockey in the NHL. I wore a Jofa helmet that was actually, it looked good. It made my mullet look good. I thought the girls dug it. And it was a helmet that was actually designed for broomball in Sweden. I never should have been allowed to wear that helmet. So I wish the NHL had protected this 20-something-year-old kid that had a chip on his shoulder, had protected me from me, and not allowed me to wear that helmet with that helmet, which ended up costing me a few concussions. So, you know, I think that's a responsibility on the leagues, that they have to do a better job at looking at this equipment, not only that protect you, but also the equipment that's hurting players. A perfect example is the elbow pads that players wear in the NHL. They're like bricks and they're causing concussions. So I just wish that they were, I know they're trying. I just wish things were moving a little bit quicker.
All right.
Awesome.
All right, great. Countdown in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Neil Haley Show, powered by VIP Internet Radio, live on my anniversary, 10 years in radio. And today's the Lyrically Lime Show, and I'm excited to welcome the program Peyton Leonard, Lyrically Lime. And Peyton, it's an exciting day to celebrate live all of this amazing stuff, amazing guests, amazing opportunities for sure. And I appreciate you calling.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
It's an interesting segment, and we might keep him on longer to learn more about the product for sure. And that's what we're all about at VIP Internet Radio and the Neil Haley Network and shows, is to talk about the product, not just this special day, but interviews to our guests, Peyton.
Awesome. So we have Ray Byrne coming to talk about National Microwave Oven Day. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Awesome.
Go ahead, Peyton, with our first question.
So can you tell us a little bit more about National Microwave Oven Day?
Yes.
Absolutely. It seems like there's a day for everything these days, doesn't it? National Microwave Day was actually founded a while ago. And it the lore is because it falls in between two major holidays. So if you think about post-Thanksgiving, you're looking to heat something up quickly. So why not have a day that especially dedicated towards heating those leftovers up?
And that's so important, to heat those leftovers up. I'm a microwave person, and I'm sorry. I will always be a microwave person for sure. Just because I'm so busy. And what a way to just say something quick, get it done, and there you go for sure.
Right.
How did National Microwave Oven Day come about? What are some fun facts about the microwave?
Absolutely. So the microwave was invented in 1945, and it was an accidental invention. So there was a self-taught American engineer named Percy Spencer who discovered it, and he was actually working for a major company, and he noticed that he had a candy bar in his pocket that was melting, and he was working on different sonar and radar waves. So all by mistake, that's how they developed it. The first microwave was actually over 6 feet tall and weighed over 700 pounds, and it has definitely come a long way since the 1940s.
Yeah, and yeah, it's amazing to know the growth of that. Go ahead, Peyton, the next question.
Awesome. So what authentic deli-style sandwiches does Ray Byrne's offer?
Absolutely. So Ray Byrne's is really known for our bakery soft bread right out of the microwave. So this is a really big day for us. We're the number one seller of Philly cheesesteak in the United States. That is our number one product. Number two is going to be we have a wonderful ham and Swiss on pretzel roll. And again, both of these are designed specifically for the microwave, 90 seconds in, let it cool down a little bit, and it's good to eat.
Wow. Yum.
So that sounds yummy for sure. And I might have a different follow-up question to kind of go from that. But it's just something that you can go ahead and in your busy schedule, go ahead and have a nice lunch, snack, dinner, whatever with this product, right?
That's right. Yeah, they're great for on the run. So I'll pop one in the microwave when I'm running to an event and I don't necessarily have time for dinner. Or if I'm at home at night and it's post-dinner, I'm looking for a snack. It's just real quick. It goes straight from the freezer into the microwave, and they're really great for on the run snacks or meals.
Awesome. Good, Peyton. Next question.
Awesome. So can you tell us a little bit about how the Ray Byrne's brand came to be?
Absolutely. So we're located in the San Francisco Bay Area, although we manufacture down in Tupelo, Mississippi. So over 30 years ago, Ray and Bernie envisioned sharing their love of New York-style deli sandwiches with the world. It took a while to develop a bread that works specifically in the microwave, but they have absolutely perfected the bread so that it's bakery soft right out of the microwave. And it also took them a little bit of time to develop the meats and cheeses and tried a whole bunch of different things with the Philly and the pastrami recipes. Today we sell multiple millions of sandwiches each year, and you can find us in the frozen aisle.
Wow, that's awesome.
And I think it definitely is an awesome thing. And you love to have the opportunity to have a great sandwich. So tell us your background a little bit. You know, you're probably not used to this kind of a live interview kind of situation, not because we have it for a little bit of longer segment. How long have you been with Ray Byrne's?
I've been with Ray Byrne's for about a year, but I have a really non-traditional background. I have 2 degrees in organic and analytical chemistry. I was an organic chemist and a flavor chemist for about 8 years. And then I have my MBA, and I'm currently working on my PhD. So I am literally a jack of all trades.
Wow.
And I had this opportunity that popped up with Ray Byrne's, and it's a really neat company. They're going through a lot of transition, but the foundation is solid. These sandwiches are great. The first time I tried them, I thought, okay, here we go, a microwavable sandwich. But when I tried it, I've absolutely fallen in love with the product. So it's a really cool company to work for.
It definitely seems like a really cool company, and I hope that you guys can send me some samples so I can try it out to test it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely have to let you know for sure. And that's the kind of stuff I like, is have a good sandwich like that. And to have something that you, Rayburn's is the kind of company where you don't have to go to one of those other sandwich shops. You can just do it right in the house. And you're not going to find a lot of them that you can microwave that's going to taste as good, right?
That's right.
Awesome. So what other tidbits have you learned from National Microwave Day in the company? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, I went and did a little bit of research on the chemistry and the science behind microwaves, and they're kind of interesting because you'll hear from time to time about the safety of a microwave. And I think about it a lot as an oven. So, you know, if you're using an oven the right way, it's a very safe way of heating something up. Microwaves actually heat things up from the inside. So you've got these little microwaves that go through the molecules of the food. And what they do is they're sending energy. It comes from, you know, the electricity current. They send the energy into these molecules, it gets them excited, and then they release heat. And that's how you end up cooking things in the microwave. The microwaves themselves fall within what they call the electromagnetic spectrum, which is also where you see visible light. So the reason we see different colors is the same reason we're able to cook our foods.
That's fantastic. Best place we can find information on Rayburn's and learn more about you, where can we go?
Yeah, you can check us out at rayburns.com. We're also on Facebook at Rayburns and Instagram at Rayburn Sandwiches.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I really am interested in learning more about them. Thanks again for coming on, and I'm sure you have other days to share with us as well, and we'll have Rayburns on again. So I appreciate you calling.
Great. Thanks for having us on.
All right, take care. All right, bye-bye.
Bye. All right, bye.
Go ahead and introduce our guest.
Absolutely. You know, people wonder, where are the wrestlers, right? And we have Duke the Dumpster, and he was really big, and now he's doing all sorts of stuff, special needs. So I'm excited to have him on. I mean, he's got so much going on. I want him to introduce himself. Duke, welcome to the show. Tell us what the heck you've been doing for the last few years since you've been out of wrestling.
The last few years, I am actually working in the drug courts or recovery court program here in the county that I live in Middle Tennessee, you know, working with individuals who are facing jail or prison time with an underlying substance abuse problem and perhaps mental health issues. And, you know, we take them out of jail and we put them through a very strict supervision program that's coupled with, you know, recovery skills and treatment classes and counseling as well.
That's amazing. And that's wonderful. And that's so needed in today's society, because that's, you know, homelessness, these shootings, it's all stemming from mental illness and not knowing what a person's got to do. And many of them are on drugs, and you're going right for the core. You're going right for the jugular vein. Good. Kudos to you.
Yeah, you know, it's something that's a bit different. There's really not much in terms of programming offered in the jail setting or even in the prison setting that tends to work. This program kind of eases them back into living in society. Like I said at the beginning, it's very strict. And as they work their way through the program, it's a year and a half program. Each phase they work through, they earn a little bit more freedom as they, you know, get back into living their lives as normally as possible. And we also teach them to live life without, you know, using drugs and alcohol and things of that nature.
Wow.
And so let's start, Dave, the story, because honestly, get to him in wrestling first, because what led Duke to where he is, or Mike is Mike, but again, Duke, everyone calls Duke the Dumpster.
Yeah.
Percy, he went through a transformation because of a story. He never thought he would be where he is today, and yet he's happy because he feels fulfilled. And so go ahead and ask that first question, Dave.
Yeah, well, it all started in wrestling. So how did you go from being, you know, Duke to this amazing wrestler?
Well, I mean, I grew up watching wrestling. I loved it. I grew up in South Florida, you know, the old days, championship wrestling from Florida with Dusty Rhodes, Ric Flair, you know, Barry Windham, Lex Luger. And I was a big fan growing up. So I knew early on, well, probably about high school, I knew that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to become a professional wrestler. And I still went to college and did all the things you should do to have a fallback plan. But my focus all along was becoming a professional wrestler. So I one day kind of hatched a scheme when I found out that actually Vince McMahon, the owner of the World Wrestling Federation,
we have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shakeup to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
CyberStation USA.
CyberStation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. CyberStation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple.
Stitcher,
a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA, always on the go.
Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The CyberStation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide.
Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.
Wrestling Federation was at a convention in my hometown in Miami, actually in Miami Beach. And I just put on a suit and got some credentials from a TV executive that I was friends with. And I just kind of crashed the convention. I just walked in there like I was an executive and walked right up to Vince McMahon and told him I wanted a job, handed him a videotape and walked back out of there. And they called me a week later and brought me up for a tryout. And then I was working for the World Wrestling Federation in about 1994.
That's what it takes sometimes, just not giving up, not taking no for an answer, being bold, being courageous, and you did it.
Yeah, and you know, in a lot of ways, I would say, you know, I realized the dream and I became a professional wrestler at the highest level. But, you know, it also came with a lot of drawbacks and a lot of other issues. You take a beating. I tell people that professional wrestling, that business, it's like being in a moderate car accident on a nightly basis. People don't realize, even though it's predetermined, you take a beating. And, you know, you start, your body gets worn out. And sometimes people make poor decisions, like trying to self-medicate, you know, start taking pain medication and things of that nature, or drinking a lot of alcohol to make it through the pain issues. And unfortunately, while I was in the WWF, that is something I did, and it started to negatively affect my wrestling career. And that was basically the beginning of the end.
Yeah, so much for the people who say that wrestling is fake, huh?
Oh, no, don't do that. Dave, Mike and I are going to have to come get you. That's for sure.
And not me. I'm talking about a lot of people.
As a former professional wrestler, I just, you know, see this. The business, you were surprised so much. You thought once you got that contract, your life was set, right? Champagne and caviar dreams growing up watching wrestling. And then you thought, once I'm in the big time, my life is going to be perfect, right?
That's exactly what I thought. I thought I was going to be rich and famous right away. And it didn't exactly work out that way. It was a much tougher business and industry to kind of navigate your way through. and at times I did not do it correctly. It was very difficult, and it was very hard on the body, both. So, yeah, it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be coming out of the gate. It was a bit of a rude awakening in the beginning.
So what would you say? Go ahead, Mike.
You go, Dave.
What would you say is your greatest moment in the WWE?
My greatest moment in the WWE, that's an interesting question. You know, just going out on live television, you know, there's several answers to that question, but I will say, you know, pay-per-views and stuff like that, but the very first time I went out on Monday Night Raw on live TV, so no mistakes, and did an angle with Jerry the King Lawler, and I mean, I was both excited and scared to death and so many other things at the same time, but it was live television. And I just remember right before I walked out the curtains, I said, put up or shut up, brother. It's time to go. And that's what happened. We went out and we set up a great angle. And that was probably one of the most important moments when I realized, okay, I can probably do this. So,
wow.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing that I felt at times when you're in front of that crowd, and that becomes addicting, doesn't it? You become that persona in so many ways. And I think professional wrestlers that finally reflect in their careers and look back, what truly is the addicting fact, and we're going to talk about addiction in this interview, is that you're addicted to the fans. You're addicted to the crowd. It's like you feel like there's nothing better than that feeling, right?
That is exactly the way it is. It is an addiction, and people don't realize, you know, walking out in front of a huge crowd of people that are either cheering or booing you, whatever the case may be, but the fact is you can walk out and have control over such a huge crowd of people on a nightly basis. And if, you know, if they're fans and they love you and they cheer you, and people want your autograph all the time, and it's just that lifestyle where you are constantly being held up on this pedestal, and people don't realize sometimes when it comes to an end abruptly, people are not prepared for that. Walking out those curtains on a nightly basis is like a drug rush. And when all of a sudden it's gone, overnight, it can be quite a difficult transition for people to make. That's why a lot of people turn to drugs and alcohol to cope, because they can't find that feeling anywhere else because they're no longer in the industry.
Is that how you became addicted to drugs and alcohol? Just doing that?
Well, I would definitely say that was a huge part of it, but it started really with just the bumps and the bruises and taking a beating, you know, the physical beating your body takes. And that's where I got used to taking them. But then, you know, at least when you're in the World Wrestling Federation, even at that time, you know, they've got you on a pretty strict schedule of having to make towns and do shows and make appearances. But when it was all over, and basically there was nobody looking over my shoulder anymore, the drug and alcohol use really got bad.
And that's, yeah. And so that's the thing, is the pain. Explain to people the ring in the WWF/WWE is a lot harder ring than some of these indie rings that are like cushions. Right. And I mean, I remember when I did TV Shotgun Saturday Night and wrestled Savio Vega and Crush, and I took a bump. I couldn't believe how hard of it. It's almost, and the ring is almost as hard as Germany, where it felt like I was bumping on concrete. Night
yes.
out taking those bumps.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know. Yeah, they think that the ring is like a trampoline. And the ropes are like just hitting rubber bands and bouncing all around and having a great time. And that is not the case. That ring, back in those days, that wrestling ring was very hard. And in fact, at times I had this move where I would jump up in the air and spin around and drop an elbow on my opponent, but my upper back took the brunt of that blow against the mat. And the thing was, in those rings at that time, the further away you got from the center of the ring, the harder the ring was. And I actually, without knowing it, fractured a vertebrae by dropping this elbow on people on a nightly basis, and found out probably 11 years later that I had fractured a vertebrae in my, you know, thoracic vertebrae. And it was a very heavy ring. And I always laugh at people that say, well, yeah, wrestling's great or whatever. And I invite them to just get in a ring and try hitting the ropes. Just hit the ropes one time.
The bruises you get, even if you've not been, you wrestle for so many years and you take time off, like you made your comeback, you ran those ropes and you're like, they hurt as much as they did when your first time, because you back up, you're tough, and you have bruises, you walk over, you come back and you say, well, what did you do today training? Well, my back's hurting. Oh my gosh, it's no one thinks about this. And I feel bad for these young guys today, Mike. They take too many bumps. They're going to be so screwed up, and they're going to be shot 20 years before us in a way, because it's ridiculous what their bumps are taking.
Yeah, and they're doing more and more of that stuff outside the ring, or they're landing on rails, or they're landing on concrete floors, and that's the really doesn't give. And yeah, you're probably going to see a lot of guys, you know, people, we think when we're young, we think in our 20s, we think we're invincible. And I remember hearing guys like Bret Hart and Scott Hall joke that, you know, when they got into the Hall of Fame, somebody was going to have to wheel them out there in a wheelchair. And that's not far from the truth with a lot of people. People that work that style of high flying and high impact, your body takes a beating and it adds up. It definitely adds up.
And then when you're young, you don't care. And we'll talk about that. And I'm sure that Dave's question will lead to that young process. But go to the next question, Dave.
Yeah, you know, how do wrestlers, but more importantly, how did you know that it was the end of the line was coming and you kind of hit rock bottom?
Well, as far as the end of the line with wrestling, before I was there for just over 2 years in the World Wrestling Federation. And as I stated before, I started using more and more painkillers to get through the pain. And it made me irrational. Mentally, it made me irrational. I was not making good decisions. I was talking to people like Vince McMahon, like in ways I shouldn't, unprofessionally. And I knew that I wasn't going to be there much longer because I didn't want to be there. I just wasn't happy with any of it. And the drug use made a lot worse. So, you know, after about 2.5 years, I ended up leaving. And, you know, I went home to nothing. I went home to just, you know, more drugs and more alcohol. But I would say rock bottom. The first time I thought I hit rock bottom, I was living in Miami, Florida, in what I would call a drug house, on a mattress in the middle of a room where the dogs would come in and use the bathroom on the floor because that was their room. And I couldn't move because I needed drugs or alcohol just to get up and move. And that was when I finally went to rehab the first time, at least, and moved to Tennessee to get away from the Florida influences and stuff. But yeah, that was probably the first time I hit rock bottom, but there was another.
Yeah. It, it's a surprise that that's when you hit rock bottom, but then you said, okay, I'm going to turn around my life and go to something else. And you did recover the first time.
Yeah. I got clean. I came to Tennessee. I went to rehab and did all that. And then I was just discouraged with the fact of how low I had gotten. So I became determined to rebuild my life. And I started going back to school. I got a master's degree in education. I became a school teacher and a coach and all these great things. But the one thing I didn't realize I was missing during that first recovery was actual recovery. I was not going to meetings. I was not getting out in the recovery community. I was not taking care of my addiction issues. I just figured, okay, I'm off drugs. Now I'm going to get my life back. And a lot of times they call that, you know, being a dry drunk or a dry addict, where you're living life like white knuckling it, all the way. And, you know, unfortunately, in about 2009, when I had a foot injury that got really bad, I made the mistake of thinking I could take pain medication again. And that was the big major relapse that I had.
Wow. So who helped you finally recover from all of that?
The Warren County Sheriff's Department. you know, it's
yeah, they're
funny.
Really good at that.
Yeah. Well, I always tell people, in order for us to really want to change, stuff has to get painful enough. At least when it comes to addiction and things like that, things got to get painful for us to finally make a change. And I was in a situation where I was using drugs. By day, I was hanging on to a teaching job barely. And then in the evenings, I was running around getting drugs with people I shouldn't have been hanging with. And I ended up getting in trouble. And one day the police came to my house and arrested me on drug charges for selling pills. And I've got two felonies on my record now. But that was the moment where I knew, okay, this has to end, and I have to do it the right way this time. And I've been doing
We have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shakeup to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
CyberStation USA.
CyberStation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. CyberStation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple. Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA. Always on the go.
Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The CyberStation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide.
Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.
And I've been doing it the right way ever since, just over 6 years now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Neil Haley Show. And I'm excited about our guest today. I love talking sports, and I love Triumph Books. And we're going to talk Packers today. And as a Pittsburgh Steeler fan, one of the biggest sad things was the Packers beating us in the Super Bowl. And I have talked to a couple Packer players about that awesome memory, but I'm excited to welcome the program author Jason Wilde, author of The Big 50, Green Bay Packers, the men and moments that made the Green Bay Packers. Jason, thanks for calling. How are you?
Oh, Neil, thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it, buddy.
You know, I just, when I think Green Bay Packers, you think tradition. Between us and this, and meaning Pittsburgh Steelers and Green Bay Packers, it is the true tradition of professional football. And the NFL, those two travel everywhere you go, right? They're Packer fans at every stadium, as there are Steeler fans at every stadium. It's one place that they people from the Milwaukee area and Green Bay area, they basically always end up relocating, just kind of like Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, it's really remarkable how both those team fan bases travel. And obviously, when you play each other in a Super Bowl like the Packers and Steelers did in 2010, you really got a feeling. I'll never forget this, being around Dallas that week, of how similar those fan bases are. You know, there's certainly a blue-collar element to a lot of the fans. They're passionate. They love their team. They live and die with their teams. And that's not always the case with all NFL fan bases. And so, you know, the fact that they put their money where their fandom is, right, with whether it's how many jerseys they own or how willing they are to spend their travel budget of their family to go to games in different cities. It's really remarkable how supportive both those teams are. And, you know, obviously for much of my career, I covered a guy who was from Pittsburgh and who grew up a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, who brought what Ted Thompson called Pittsburgh macho to Green Bay.
Yes.
And that was Mike McCarthy, who obviously had a bunch of success here in his 13-year run as the head coach.
Absolutely. And so let's talk about your background really quick, Jason, getting into this interview, because we do have some time. I love having a producer because I just can enjoy asking questions I might not have time for in my normal studio type days. But tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, this is year 26 for me on the beat. I started out as a backup and really kind of learning the ropes of covering the NFL. And the great thing is when you've been doing it this long and covering three different Super Bowl teams, and you just accumulate so many stories and so much experience. I don't like to think of myself as an old guy, because when I started out, I was lucky to be a really young guy. But the institutional knowledge and the things you get to see during your time being on a beat, you know, and covering a team year in and year out and being at every game, you just have such a great feel for the history that you're just fortunate to be there to chronicle. And so I've been really lucky to be able to do this for as long as I have. I hope I get to do it for another 20-plus years. But, you know, there's been great seasons for the Packers. There's been down seasons during my time, but there's also been some really compelling seasons that didn't end in Super Bowl titles, but certainly ended in unforgettable games and things that I got to see that I think anyone who believes that sports are a very valuable part of our society and mean a lot to a lot of people, it was cool to be able to be a part of it.
Definitely, it seems like it was cool to be part of that type of thing in the tradition. We talk about the Roonies, and we'll get into the Big 50. And I'm going to try to come up with what I think when you talk about Packers and what you wrote about in the book. But when you talk about organizations, you talk about the Steeler organization with the Roonies. What, being part of the Packer organization, do they have that kind of same family feel with the owners of the Packers?
They do. And you know, the beauty of it is obviously they're community owned, that they sell stock to that fans are actually able to own for, you know, $250 or whatever. They can only do it every so often. They haven't had a stock sale in a long time now, number of years since they expanded part of their stadium. But they don't have, you know, the next best thing to having the Roonies as your owner is to not have an owner at all. And you've seen, obviously, with the Steelers, what stability they have had there for so long with, you know, first Chuck Knoll and then with Bill Cowher. And, you know, we've obviously, there's been some ups and downs during Mike Tomlin's tenure, but, you know, there's just this, they're never that team in either the Packers case or the Steelers case where you look at them going, God, they don't seem like they know what they're doing. You know, it just isn't the case anymore with most other teams. There's always those years where you're like, God, what are they doing? And do they have a plan? And, you know, even now you look at the Steelers and the season that they've endured and the things they've done at quarterback and the fact that they're still in contention, I think says a lot. The Packers weren't able to do that when they lost Aaron Rodgers
No.
in 2013 and again in 2017. So, you know, that's one way that this franchise obviously has been very fortunate, that there have been very few times where they've had either Brett Favre or Aaron Rodgers not available to them to lead them to a lot of victories.
We have the duck. Come on now, Jason. That's why. The duck. I brought up with the author of the Browns, Zach. I said to him, I predicted this before. I said, he's going to be a good quarterback. And it's not going to be Mason Rudolph. So we have the duck. Spurgis loves the duck. I guess if he wins another game, they're going to already get ready to name a street after him. But again, we'll see how long that love of the duck goes. But let's go. You didn't have a great backup when Aaron Rodgers got hurt. So how many years of the Packers do you cover in this book?
So we cover them from their inception to modern day. And obviously it's hard to narrow 100 years of football into 50 chapters. And so my good buddy Drew Olson wrote the more historic chapters, and I focused on the nearly quarter century of time I covered the team for my chapters. And, you know, my favorite story that has come out of doing the book, Ron Wolf was the Packers general manager who rebuilt this franchise and brought them back from oblivion and traded for Brett Favre and signed Reggie White and hired Mike Holmgren. And he and I got together, and he was here in town a couple of weeks ago, and he said, "I've got a bone to pick with you." I'm like, "What? There's a Pro Football Hall of Famer that's telling you he's got a bone to pick with you." He's like, "How do you pick Super Bowl 45 as the number one thing in your book?" Well, first of all, I was really excited that he actually even looked at our book. But more importantly, I had to explain to him it's not a ranking. So there's 50 chapters, but that's the most recent triumph that they've had.
It's not the 100 things. Right.
It was just most recent. So after that, he calmed down and he didn't have a bone to pick with me anymore.
So that's not 100 things, the 100 things live and die Packers, then that definitely wouldn't have been number one, right?
Like no, I think there's just so much to get to it. Frankly, we could have done 3 books of 50 things and still had stuff left over.
Writing the book on your end, looking at specifically the Packers, what did you do in your research to try to figure out what's the best things to fit in when there's just so many great memories the Packers have?
Yeah, it was, it was obviously a challenge to narrow it down. The nice thing for me anyway is because of my career arc, I was here for so many of those moments. And, I wasn't there obviously for the Lombardi years. I wasn't even alive yet for most of them. But the fact that I covered most of the things that I write about in the book it really did make things kind of easy for me, because from a research perspective, yeah, I went back and read my stories and read other people's stories and refreshed my memory, but I lived through most of the parts that I wrote about. So I was really fortunate in that. I was able to think back to what I was thinking about back then when those things were happening and have that perspective of having lived through them.
You definitely had that, and that's the interesting thing. When I think of Green Bay Packers, I think Brett Favre. You just think one of the gunslingers. How amazing was it to watch him play?
Yeah, it was really incredible, and it's hard to believe that a franchise like the Packers have been able to have two back-to-back Hall of Fame quarterbacks in him and Rodgers. It's just funny because they're just such different guys. I mean, Favre used it. He was a gunslinger. He took so many chances, and not only did he retire at the time with the most touchdown passes in NFL history, he also retired with the most interceptions in NFL history. Whereas Rodgers, he's going to be a Hall of Famer also, and he's going to go in with almost assuredly with the best touchdown interception ratio in NFL history, because he's going to have so few interceptions. They're just vastly different guys, and yet they were both great in their own right. And I think, obviously for Rodgers, it's kind of like with Ted Thompson and Ron Wolf. It's different when you continue a tradition as opposed to when you restore a tradition. And obviously Wolf and Holmgren and White and Favre were responsible for restoring a tradition that had become so tarnished over almost 3 decades, that it's just a lot different than what it is with what Aaron Rodgers has done in recent years.
The difference between Aaron Rodgers and Brett Favre in comebacks, you think of, Brett Favre, the gunslinger, taking the chances, but then you think of Aaron Rodgers as the Hail Mary, the guy that just pulls stuff out you wouldn't imagine. And you wouldn't think that coming out of college he would be this kind of quarterback, the one that you want with 2 minutes left in the game.
Yeah, and there was a time in his career where he wasn't that guy. You know, he didn't have a lot of come from behind victories, and people questioned that. And, you know, I always said that during those really, his MVP seasons, he had a lot of game-winning drives. They just happened in the third quarter where they put teams away early.
We have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shakeup to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
CyberStation USA.
CyberStation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. CyberStation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple.
Stitcher,
a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA. Always on the go.
Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The CyberStation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide.
Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.